Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker and program moderator, Matt Eisenbrandt. Matt Eisenbrandt is a former legal director for the Center for Justice and Accountability, CJA, where he was a member of the trial team that brought Oscar Romero's assassination to court. The California lawsuit against former Air Force Captain Alvaro Saravia for his role in the murder of Archbishop Romero is the subject of Assassination of a Saint. While at CJA, Matt was also involved in a federal trial in Tennessee against Nicholas Carranza, resulting in a jury verdict finding Carranza liable for crimes against humanity in El Salvador. Matt also participated in successful cases against military commanders from Haiti and Honduras. Matt is now the legal director of the Canadian Center for International Justice, CCIJ. He has led CCIJ's casework since 2008, helping survivors of torture, war crimes, and other atrocities seek justice. Matt will be joined by a distinguished panel who will discuss the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. Please join me now in welcoming Matt Eisenbrandt.
Thank you very much. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having us here tonight, and thank you to all of you for coming. So I am going to introduce the distinguished panel here to my right. This is with obviously a number of people missing, but this is the core of the team that brought the case of Archbishop Romero to trial. And I'm going to do just one line bios for everybody because I know we all want to hear more about the case as opposed to everybody's backgrounds. I hope that's okay. So starting nearest to me is Professor Terry Lynn Carl, who is the Gilded Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. Is that now emeritus or active?
It's emeritus.
Emeritus. There we go. And active, both. I was going to say, I was trying to figure out how to properly distinguish that. And Terry served as an expert witness, as the expert witness at trial on everything about El Salvador and about that case specifically, but not just on the Romero case, but also on other critical El Salvador trials over the years that we'll hear a little bit more about. To Terry's right is Nico Van Alstyne, who is a principal at Beveridge and Diamond. Nico has a distinguished career in many areas, but in particularly on environmental law, and was the lead counsel at trial at the time working for the Heller Ehrman Law Firm, and has a lot of other great work. But as I said, I'm gonna move quickly on these. Next to Nico, and it's good that the two of them are seated together. Next to Nico is Alma Dana Bernabeu, who is now a co-founder of a new law firm, Guernica 37 International Justice Chambers, and she and I also worked together for many years at the Center for Justice and Accountability. And I said it's good that Nico and Alma are seated next to each other because as a result of this case, they met and eventually got married and now have a lovely son, Diego. At the far end is Russell Cohen, who Russell is a partner at Orrick, Harrington and Sutcliffe LLP. He too was a member of the legal team on the Romero case at the Heller Ehrman Law Firm at that time. He and I have also had the pleasure of working on some human rights cases since that time as well. So I want to thank the team for being here with me tonight. I can't tell you what an honor it is to have all of you here with me, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion. So I think what I would like to do is start with Terry, and Terry, ask you to give what is going to be a phenomenally fast history to try to understand how it is that Archbishop Romero, the leading voice in the Catholic Church in a very Catholic country, how it is that he could have been assassinated in 1980.
So I'd just like to say that I've been the expert witness on all the successful cases against perpetrators during the Civil War in El Salvador for CJA, for the Department of Homeland Security, and now for the Justice Department. And I have never been on the stand less than 2 days. So Matt has just asked me to speak about 4 minutes. So, what I would like to do is, since I see a lot of familiar faces and I have a feeling a lot of people know that this used to be a military dictatorship, that it was allied with the oligarchy, that was largely a coffee oligarchy. There were also your McDonald's hamburgers came from El Salvador, so there was a lot of beef and agricultural interests as well. I'm not going to do that kind of history. If you want, we can do that in questions and answers. What I'd like to do is say a few things that I think people don't necessarily know that shows why this case and others like it are so important. And what I'd like to say, first of all, is if the death squad that was formed in 1977 as part of an Operation Condor kind of network of death squads and right-wing terrorists throughout Latin America, and which was then exported and linked up to Central America. If that had been stopped in 1977, where there was an effort to stop it by President Carter, then it is my firm conviction there would not have been a civil war in El Salvador. That's number one. So when you think of the somewhere between 75 to 90,000 people who died in that civil war, mostly rural peasants, and when you think of the violence that absolutely characterizes El Salvador today, including, I don't know if people saw, the unbelievable murder of their hippo at the zoo. This is a country that is now so riddled with violence its chief legacy from the Civil War. So if you think that this could have actually been stopped, that Archbishop Romero, and this was part of what I did in the case, was I analyzed the death threats. This is where I became convinced of how tragic this story is in many ways. When you analyze his death threats, he was appointed in 77. What you see is as soon as he says, I am not going to be the normal landowners military church alliance, which is what ran Latin America, not just Central America, but Latin America for a long period of time. And I'm going to break that alliance, and instead of being with the landowners and the military, I'm going to be with the poor. Now, he did not do that as a liberation theologist. This is wonderful in Matt's book, which I urge all of you to read. It's just a wonderful book. He did not do that as that. He did it as a conservative archbishop initially, who was transformed when he saw his own people being murdered because they were preaching to the poor. For that very reason, and seeing people murdered along with them. And what's so important to me about this story is if you had had what the UN often calls an early warning system, you would have known that if you didn't crack down on that small group of armed men, part of the landowning apparatus and very much linked to the security forces, which was the National Guard, the Treasury Police, and the National Police. These were small death squads, mostly people inside the military who did this as their other job. They got paid as their other job to kill anybody who might be upsetting the apple cart in this country. If you had stopped it then, it would not have done what it did, which is spread through the security forces first in a very deliberate effort to take the key people in the Romero case, by the way, many of them, the key military people, and put them as heads of the National Guard, the Treasury Police, and all the security forces. And then as they moved around and moved inside the Army, they carried those same practices with them. So those, I look around the room, I know many of you remember the stories of the death squads. There were never any death squads. Let me qualify this a minute. Death squads were always the creation of military men with support from the military. There may have been a few civilian death squads that formed on their own, but by and large, their materiel, their guns, their arms, everything came through the military. So those are the people that targeted Archbishop Romero. And they targeted him, and their anger against him is stunning. I wish I could show you some of these death squads, the language they use, you know, traitor. It's also a very fascist language. It's very important. I'm not using this as an epithet, but enemy of the people is both a Robespierre saying, a Stalin saying, and a fascist saying, just in case you've heard it lately. That's where it comes from. So the notion that Romero was an enemy of the people and that he wasn't, as the head of the Chamber of Commerce explained to me, he was not an archbishop, he was not a priest, and he was not Catholic, because the communists had taken his soul. So he was no longer any of those things, which is why it was easy to kill him, because he's not any of those things anymore. And if you read these, you see all kinds of fascist language, symbolism, etc. I'm stressing this because I think this is an extremely relevant lesson for today. If you see early warning signs, if you don't hit them hard, they spread. And the permission to spread. And that is exactly what happened in El Salvador. So that by the time we get to Archbishop Romero's murder, we'll hear more about that. I won't talk about that. But by the time we get to his murder, it is that murder that starts the Civil War, basically. I mean, there's that and the murder of some political leaders. This is a Civil War that is bookended on one hand by the murder of an archbishop, and on the other hand, the end of it is the death of six Jesuit priests. It's bookended by that. It is the most intense civil war probably in the history of Latin America, and by that I mean more people died in a shorter time than ever before, even though now it's even more violent. The kinds of things that you see in Central America today, the drug trafficking, the kids running, the incredible violence of that society is a direct result of the murder of the archbishop that set off a civil war, that left a legacy, that means there's complete impunity in most of Central America, and particularly El Salvador. So that's one thing I really want to emphasize. The other thing I want to emphasize, without going into the history anymore, is the other thing I want you to keep in mind, because we'll talk about the relevance of this. You sort of think, well, you know, he died in 1980. He's an archbishop. It's not that big a deal if you're not a... if you're not a religious person, maybe it's not. That's wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that this death squad apparatus that then spread into the military and turned the military into a much greater and more efficient killing and torture machine than it had ever been before, that is considered by many people to be a success story in the military. And that's where the notion of the Salvadoran option came from. Those people who trained those death squads then went to Iraq, and they trained the death squads in Iraq, and that is the origin of the mass killing, the targeted killings between Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq. So when I say this is a relevant story, it is a history that we won't see repeated in the landowners, the church, etc. Those days, I actually believe, are past. But the messages of what it means to be early morning, to know these guys, and we did know that they were targeting and they were going to kill Archbishop Romero. We knew it. You can see it in the desk. You can see when it rises. You see when it falls. I'm just going to end with this. I was asked at one point what the second miracle could be if Archbishop Romero was going to be made a saint. I'm not quite sure why they asked me, because I'm neither Catholic nor Christian. But I said, well, here's the second miracle. It's a miracle he lived as long as he did. And the reason I say that is that they were going to kill him. You can see it in the death threats in 1977. And in 1977, Carter and the U.S. Congress did a huge human rights push on the persecution of the Catholic Church. As a result of that, everything fell back and did not come back again until Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. When Archbishop Romero was murdered, and when the evidence of who had killed him came out, we knew it in 1980, and the killers were released, which they were, that set off the whole series of massacres, of mass murders in El Salvador that had not happened to that extent since 1932. So that's what I want to just emphasize. We can go into the actual history if you want, but as I look around, as I said, I think many people know it.
Thanks very much, Terry. And I think that note of impunity and ongoing impunity in El Salvador is a good segue to, I'm going to ask Alma Dana to talk about CJ's work on El Salvador and on seeking justice for El Salvador, but primarily in the United States.
Okay. I was getting ready for Nico to talk.
I'm jumping to you first.
Okay, let me just put my chair. So, yes. So the Center for Justice and Accountability actually started, it's not a foundational case, I shouldn't say that, but the first case in Latin America was a case related to Salvadoran events. Professor Carl Terry was also part, which is actually the consequence of a previous case that many of you may know that was brought by one of the relatives of the three nuns, four religious women that were assassinated also in 1980. So the fourth case, there was unfortunately that they lost. They didn't get a judgment, a verdict of guilt, and a judgment to transform thanks to. And I want to highlight that because there are so many. There are many in the audience, and I think it's important. Thanks to the Salvadoran community in the Bay Area, in particular, but not exclusively, and their very impetuous and very organized desire for justice that I think is as of today. The CJ was able to put together what we call the Roma Goza case, which was the first case on behalf of three torture survivors and against was, I guess, paradigmatic and a little bit of a created, I will say, some legend in the United States because it's a very, what is now cliche perhaps, but a couple of generals, both of them former ministers of defense of El Salvador, were living very happy and in a wealthy manner on Palm Beach. And they were found by the community. They were reported in kind of through the networks of solidarity that El Salvador and generally Central America had in the country. They were able to put this case together. Psychologists, activists, lawyers worked to find the proper victims. So the three torture survivors, really brave people, brought the case. So that, I think, was a little bit of that baptism, in a way, of CJ using a Catholic. It was really interesting because I think we got the advice, and I think it's true, that even though the case was very important in U.S. courts for legal reasons that I will not go in detail, the impact of the case in El Salvador was relatively small. This was a new field, the alien towards the statue, the civil suits in the United States, and the ability to impact the home countries was a little bit unknown. But there was definitely the desire of exploring more. So CJ, I think in an ad hoc way, perhaps, we had all of these strong ties to the community, really a good relationship, and we wanted to go deeper. And I think we understood from the Salvadoran people that the Romero case was going to be the paradigm for sure. And the one which is really important, it was for us at CJ, the one that really mattered to the majority of Salvadorans across. It was such a symbol of I think it was very brilliantly said by Terry, so I don't want to say, but it was the defeat, you know, all the hope for the Salvadoran people were killed when they killed the Archbishop. Mm-hmm. That man that was speaking on their behalf and kind of breaking a little bit through defending the poor. So from there, we had the Carranza case. You never know when you file these cases whether they're going to be defended or whether the defendants are going to hide or run away, and then you go into what we legally we call default. So we had another case against Nicolas Carranza, another peculiar human being, Minister of Interior or the equivalent. One of the nastiest guys, as you go through declassified documents and testimony and historic perspective of El Salvador, responsible for that, the killing of among many, the ordering the killing of the leaders, the democratic leaders, the Terry made a reference to, which was called the FDR, which in a way with the killing of Romero precipitated really the crisis and the big crisis and the civil war.
And Alma, can I just add that Carranza, I'm sorry, but Carranza is the man that I talked about that set up the death squad apparatus that was more informal inside the military. So he's the chief guy.
He's a bad guy.
He's
a
bad guy. Bad hombre.
Like
bad hombre. Bad hombre.
And Almo, I do want to mention the Jesuits case, but let's save that for a little later because I think that's sort of the present day culmination.
Okay.
If that sounds good to you, and I'm gonna move to Nico to put the Romero case on the table, and then we'll come back to the bigger picture.
Well, it picks up on this storyline that we've been hearing. You should first understand that CJA is a nonprofit. They litigate these cases, these important cases, by partnering with law firms that provide the services pro bono. So I'd never heard of CJA, but I read about the Romagosa verdict, and I went to a celebration of it for the Salvadoran community at the Women's Building in the Mission District, and my mother came with me, and it was very nice. And I met the then legal director of CJA, executive director of CJA at the time. We chatted. It's nice. So that's all good. A few years later, she calls and says, we have this case in Tennessee, a guy named Nicolas Carranza. Would you take the case? And I said, okay. And actually, that's when I dragooned Russ, who had some time. And we said, great. And we started working on it. And then we got a call a few days later saying, remember we told you about that Carranza case? Can you put that on hold? We've got another case, and we have a statute of limitations problem. It needs to be filed in
2 weeks.
1 week. 1 week. Says, what is it? Archbishop Romero. Yes. I mean, all I had to do was say that name, and we were in. It was that important. So very briefly, what the case was, Matt asked me to explain. So we brought a case under the Alien Tort Statute, which is actually the number four law ever passed by Congress in the United States in 1789. And it allows civil suits, not criminal, civil suits regarding violations of law abroad. So, and there'd been a development of use of that statute for human rights cases like this one. So there was a template for this to a certain extent. The claims that we brought were for an extrajudicial killing, clearly, and uniquely, and we'll come back to this later, crimes against humanity. Just those two claims for the killing of Archbishop Romero. We threw together the complaint. We filed it. Shall I go on to the service?
Yeah, mention Sarabia's.
So Alvaro Sarabia had been located by CJA from their research, living in Modesto, California, selling used cars. So we filed the case, and the process server locates him. And there'd been an article about him. There'd been some note. We knew where he was. We knew where he lived and the woman with whom he lived. And so we went to serve him there, and he had hightailed it. But the woman who was there in the house accepted the papers. We later persuaded the court that constituted adequate service upon him so the case was a real case at that point because he knew about it because he was living there. So, but he then hightailed it, and he didn't show up. He didn't come back. So at this point, the time period for him to respond to the lawsuit passes. It's now, what Alma mentioned before, a default. He's not going to defend the case. Now, normally in a default case, the court assumes that you've established your case. You've won. You've established liability. And the only thing to be addressed is that of the damages, the scope of the damages. That's all you have to talk about. And normally, that's not a subject of a hearing because you know, you just put in, it's a contract, right? You owe me $100, you pay the $100. That's it. We persuaded the court, and it was not easy, you were there, to grant us a week-long hearing because of the unusual nature of this case, the grave crimes that we were alleging had been perpetrated by this gentleman, Alvaro Saravia, who was the lieutenant to Roberto Dabizon, who's essentially his chief of security. And these were major allegations. So we thought it appropriate and persuaded the court to give us a week to present the evidence to ensure that it, in fact, a judgment was warranted.
And I'm just going to underscore that because it really wasn't easy. I mean, we had a judge in Modesto, former Marine. I think he was the busiest judge in the federal court system. He had the heaviest docket. And so here were these folks from this nonprofit in San Francisco up in Modesto saying, we want 1 week of your court time to prove up a case against a defendant who's gone. And so it really was an accomplishment to get him to give us a week of court time.
Fresno,
which was the closest federal court to Modesto. I'm going to play off of that piece there, Nico, and mention then what we also did in filing the case was it was against Saravia. He was the person who was in the United States. He was the defendant in our case. But we also named as defendants in the case what we called Does 1 through 10. Now, Terry talked earlier about the oligarchy, and we knew because there was a lot of general evidence, but maybe less specific name by name evidence about the involvement of certain members, very wealthy people, powerful people in El Salvador, involved in funding the death squad that carried out Romero's assassination. And Russ, I'm going to come back to you because we were discussing this earlier and I liked how you were phrasing it. So what we did as a strategy was, Nika was saying, we had this statute of limitations, so we had to get the case filed to make it sure it was filed on time, and we didn't yet have the evidence that we needed to go against those other people. So we named them as Does 1 through 10. And Russ, can you maybe talk a little bit about the sort of ambitious nature of including the Does 1 through 10 in the case?
Yeah, so I think Nico gave some sense of the importance of the case against Saravia. In taking that and then multiplying that to bring into the case the Does, who were the individuals responsible for funding the death squad operations. And that was the audacious ambition of the case, to bring in the people that were the money behind the operations. We had a sense of who these people were. We had a sense of where they lived in Miami, very well, very wealthy. And we had a sense of how this operated. But in order to be able to bring them into court, we needed to be able to develop a case with evidence that we could prove in court, allegations that we were comfortable making, witnesses that could come forward. And so, as Matt said, we started this as a Doe 1 through 10 because we did not have the evidence to go forward against the funders, though we understood a lot about it. But that was the goal. That was the goal, that this assassination was the key event, and the funding was the way in which this machine operated. So that was how we anticipated bringing forward this case.
Yeah, one thing about that, this is really important because this is prior to big USAID money. So the military has no money, basically. The way the military gets money is it gets it from the oligarchy, which pays no taxes. So the way the oligarchy gives money to the military is they have officers on their payroll, and they form these small groups that go do their bidding. So the death squad that we believed and know was responsible for the murder of Archbishop Romero actually didn't have very much money. So what happened is Roberto Dabizon, who was the founder of, he's not the founder of the death squad apparatus, that's how he was known, but he was Carranza, who you mentioned, he was Carranza's lieutenant. Saravia was his lieutenant, just so you get the chain. But Dawisong was this incredibly charismatic, smart, very, very ideological guy, and the oligarchy loved him. So he flew to Miami. We know this. He had meetings. He met with Jesse Helms. People remember Jesse Helms well. He was introduced to a lot of money. They set up something called, I think it was called the Salvadoran Freedom Association or something like that. And this was the money that paid for the murder. So I just want to make it really clear that it came from Miami. It then went into El Salvador to buy the weapons, to buy the sniper weapons, to buy all the things that were eventually used in the assassination of Archbishop Romero.
Sorry, there was a little high-pitched. I don't know if that's from the microphones or not, but hopefully everybody's okay and this isn't too painful.
This is going to pivot to the...
Go right ahead. Go right ahead, Nico.
So that's what we sought to do. And we had the high-level meetings with very important people, emblematic people in El Salvador early on. And we were determined to follow the evidence where it took us and bring a case against the financiers, the intellectual authors of the crime, if we could. As Matt well details in the book, we got a lot of great evidence, incredible evidence, and there's a lot of great stories there that we won't have time to tell tonight. But unfortunately, we did not get enough. We did not feel that we had enough to be able to name the does and to take the case to that level. So we were stuck with Saravia and Romero. So now, what are we going to do with this default hearing for a week? What are we going to put on? Right? Because we're no longer going after the does, which had been our real ambition. So I had this brilliant idea. Well, you'll find out because it wasn't brilliant. But,
trying on the glove?
Yeah, no, not that bad. I want to pick up on a point that Terry very well made at the beginning here, which was, you know, the importance of this history and this case in terms of the Salvadoran option that unfortunately we have seen play out so bloodily so many times since. But there's the other side that I think is equally important and also highly relevant today, and that is the example of Romero and what he stood for and the impact that a single individual can have and how profoundly important that is, was, and is. So the brilliant idea that I had was to use this week to explain the importance of Romero and what his impact was. And one of the ideas that I had was to gather declarations from the full breadth of Salvadoran society, from campesinos to exalted folks, to testify to the importance of this man and what he did in that short 3-year period. We ended up with declarations from 4 Nobel Peace Prize winners, campesinos who were illiterate, and a really wide variety of people, and a really interesting array of live witnesses who were going to come and testify about the importance of Romero. And that was the plan. That's not what happened.
Yeah. So that's perfect segue to tell the story of the person who became our sort of secret witness at trial. If we had a bit more time, we'd go into a little bit more of the background evidence about Romero's assassination and what we knew. But I think I'm going to skip past that to get to some good stories. So, Almudena, would you tell us about... So I will preface this very quickly. In 1987, the getaway driver for the assassination, so the person who drove the shooter to the church to carry out the murder, testified in El Salvador and named Saravia and Dawisong as being implicated in the murder. So we thought, well, that's someone who's been on the record. Maybe we can find him. And Almo, I'm going to give you the floor to tell the story of how we figured out at least partially where he was.
How far do I get to the... I just tell him where he is when we find him.
No, tell your story about how you found out about him.
Yeah, then I was the lucky piece of this team because then I had to dig in El Salvador and do the investigation. That was my role. And heck if I enjoyed it. So I don't know when, early on, since I was assigned with Matt to the case at CJA, someone had handed me one of those yellow folders that says, I don't think there's a case unless you find a driver. And I don't really know what he meant at the time, you know, but we'll find a driver. I didn't know the facts, so whatever. There's got to be some driver somewhere. So when you learn the facts, there are two people, or one person that is very much connected to Sarabia, and without expanding on the facts, and is the person that drove Sarabia and the actual shooter, because that's the way he was killed. He was... I was about to say performing. I'm sorry, Reverend. He was celebrating as a religious service for a funeral in a tiny, tiny, if you guys have visited, Divina Providencia in El Salvador. So it's so small that actually with the kind of gun that we believe it was used and from the car, these were, you know, so a lot of hypotheses, but one of them, pretty strong hypothesis, is they shot from the car. And while the driver was there, the driver was a member of the military, lower rank, associated also with the death squads. The driver had completely disappeared, evaporated over the years. We didn't know. We had we traced him all the way to some testimony that he provided to a former president in the context of an investigation somehow imposed or sponsored by the United States, but we didn't know anything. The only thing we knew is the name of his wife, and eventually through members again of the Salvadoran community, that his wife had a daughter of a first marriage who was in El Salvador. I guess the anecdote is the best piece. I don't know how I can make this any faster, but there were a little bit tough days, and I was this a little bit younger than now. I guess I was still very young, but a little bit younger than now. But looking, so I was traveling, sometimes alone, sometimes with my colleagues here. And in this particular occasion, Matt had a difficulty, so he couldn't travel with me. So we drag a partner, David, from another law firm that will be later a partner of CJ as well, and a wonderful person that should be in this table somehow, to El Salvador. But because of the circumstances and because of the cases, even though things had changed in El Salvador, it's not that you can go around asking about Monsignor Romero's shooter and be in good shape. So I had a bodyguard, so to speak, which is bodyguard for an NGO. It's the following. It's a great friend who's a former singer who weighs 300 pounds and who knocked everybody down at, you know, with Paulino Espinosa. So Paulino, and he hire another person who helped him at the UCA, the University of Central America, also with activities, cultural activities. So those were my bodyguards, you know, a former musician, a guitarist, and his right hand. And this right hand guy had a horrible sense of humor and was constantly telling jokes about sex. So I was with this partner from a law firm who was clearly uncomfortable with all these sex jokes. So we didn't know each other. So for the most part, the trip was about getting Guayo to shut up, you know, so because I was very junior at CJ. I'm looking at these lawyers like, how can I explain this, you know, that we all do this in Spanish? So the trip, we ended up going to a little town, which was near San Salvador, Quetzaltepeque. In that little town was the last time that we had traced the daughter, hopefully you follow me, guys, the daughter of the wife of the driver, as we knew it, from the community. And so, well, let's go on a Sunday, market day, horrible idea, but let's go. And then this guy, the second bodyguard that I had, the bad jokes guy, while we became friends, and he and I were sitting in the back in an effort to keep him away from the partner from the law firm. And then so he kept asking me questions. It was a very funny thing because he was from Quetzaltepeque, and a big part of his family was there. He had told me he was one of the many victims of the war. He actually, his parents, one abandoned him, the other one was killed in the war, and he was raised by an uncle. Let's see if I can remember everything. And his uncle was a doctor. And he talked all the time. So it's like all this information is coming. And so start asking me, so what are we doing in Quetzaltepeque? Who are we going to see in Quetzaltepeque? Why are we going to... And I was like, keeping the notes away, because you have to be a little bit careful, there was nobody really knew except for Paulino, the driver, where we were going. So finally he says, well, tell me the name of the person. I guess I said, we're going to try to find someone. He's like, well, tell me the name of the person that you are looking for. And I had in my notes a very, very, very skeleton, really bullet points, the name of the daughter and the name, possibly two names of her husband's, or two names that could be associated to her husband's, one of them a doctor. But that's all the information that we had. So, you know, we were close to Quetzaltepeque, so why not? So I said, well, I'm looking for this woman, and then maybe, and I said one of the names of the doctors, just to see. And then he looked at me and says, why are you looking at the man? Why are you looking for the man? And I said, well, because, you know, maybe associated to someone. He's like, that's my uncle. So, of course, my blood freeze. I mean, just like pick up track with this, you know, why you wonderful guy. It's like, why are you looking for my uncle? And I was like, well, and then I had to explain where he's married, we believe. And then he immediately says, oh, my God, I know who you're looking for. He's married to the wife of this guy associated with the killing of Romero. So it's like, okay, can you give me the phone number? And he actually said, you want me to call him? It's like, I was shaking. Like, what do you mean? Like, you want me to call it? I'm sure he's home. Let's call him. So we did, just to try to be brief. He did call him, and he said, didn't say anything. He's like, I have a couple of friends here. We're going to show up in your house on a Sunday. So we did. And I guess the anecdote, and it's worth saying, this was closer to elections time in El Salvador. So we walked into this house, a very Central American house, if you guys, which has a comfortable family, has a patio in the middle, which is always beautiful because they have all these beautiful plants, everything grows. And we crossed the beautiful patio, and then suddenly I look up, and there's like the biggest flag I've ever seen in my life of the right-wing party, Arena. It's like, okay, we are in a friendly home for sure. So it's like, how am I going to bring up your wife, your father-in-law, and everything? But we did. It was difficult, but, you know, we, like, almost like this, everybody tried to take a turn and see how we can ask. And what happened is that he was extremely difficult and extremely antagonistic. I mean, he felt threatened by this lawyer. Why do you want to know this? Who are you suing? He refused initially for perhaps, I don't remember, but maybe for an hour or so with, you know, tea and little girls dancing and everything to give us any information. I've never been probably more out of place in the sense of, until I relax. There's a point when I relax and I started asking, or begging is a little exaggerating, but, you know, kind of asking how much. And then it's amazing how we humans, even when we try to hide information, we give information away. And perhaps if we try to hide it is when we give more. But he started hinting. We had amongst us some conversations about a speculation about this man being protected somehow. How can he disappear? There was no record of his death. And he hinted, finally said something. I don't really remember how I put all the dots together, that he received calls because the mother, as a good mother, from somewhere, keeps calling the daughter to check on the daughter and the grandchildren. And some of those things that mothers and fathers cannot stop, no matter the circumstances. And he said something about calling from a different place every time or something like that, that made me believe that he could be, and I guess I leave it there, no? Oh, he could be. We believe, and I called my colleagues, like, in hysterical mood, in the Witness Protection Program in the United States. The way he was describing, I don't know why I know this. I don't think I knew any of this. He was just the genesis of the conversation, and perhaps in relation to a lot of our own as legal team discussions, that I thought there's a good chance that he has brought the news to my colleagues and the rest.
Yeah, and so we've got a few minutes before I'm going to go into the questions. I would like to maybe go to Russ and to Nico to tie them together after we discovered that he was likely in the Witness Protection Program. Russ, tell us about
where we went from there. This was an amazing discovery. This person who we were searching for, who is going to be a witness to the fact that Saravia was the key person involved in the assassination, is in the Witness Protection Program. But now what? Like, how do you find somebody in the Witness Protection Program? And Who runs the witness protection program? We had no idea where you would even begin to look for somebody in the witness protection program. And so we cast around. It was the early days of the internet. We found some information. Turns out that the witness protection program is run by the U.S. Marshals Service. So that was a start. We reached out to the U.S. Marshals Service. We sent them a letter asking for information. We heard nothing back. Eventually, we were getting tremendous pro bono help from Leisha Kozlowski and the Mintz Group. And Leisha's here. And connected us with some amazing investigators who had some very high-level connections at the Witness Protection Program. So we wrote another letter to the general counsel of the Witness Protection Program. And then I had a phone call. And it was a bizarre phone call. Everything was in hypotheticals. If, for example, you had a person in the Witness Protection Program that we wanted to speak with, what would we do? Well, I can't tell you. I know you can't tell me whether this person is in the program, but assuming they were, what would have to happen? Well, you would have to write a letter, and you would have to explain what you would want to talk to them about, and then we would, if they were in the program, and I'm not saying they're in the program, give them the letter and have them call you. They're like, thank you. I called these guys. This was bizarre, but I think he's in the program. I think they know who we're talking about. So,
and then Nico.
So the letter was then sent, and one day I'm sitting at my desk, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and there's a voice on the other end of the line that says, "Hello, I'm told I'm supposed to tell you that I am witness number 5145. Well, now I have a problem.
You don't know who that is.
We had asked about two people in the witness protection program. So given this history of conditional questions, I had to ask questions without asking too probingly to try to figure out which one this was. We talked for a while. We got on the talk. He identified himself, and then it took... Should I move on to from there?
Yeah, give us the quick version from there.
So the real quick version is he needed some help. We were able to put him in touch with some people that helped his son. And although there was no quid pro quo or anything like that, but that's kind of how he gained his trust. And we, Almudena and I, eventually went down to a city and met with him in a hotel. And we heard him tell his story. Similar to what had been recounted in the testimony in 1987. But this, over the next, I don't know how many months, 4 months, he would call all the time. We met with him several times. We eventually took his deposition, eventually testified at the trial. Every time we spoke with him, a little bit more would come out. The very first time we met with him, you know, he's telling this story, and he could only get so far before he'd break down in tears. And then each time he would get a little bit farther and then break down in tears. And each time a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, telling the story all the way. And that played out at the hearing, at the trial, where he finally testified in person. And he told stories there of having participated in countless death squad killings. I mean, this was his job. He got up in the morning and drove the killers, and they shot some people and he drove them home. And the judge is just,
and
yeah.
And he shot some people.
I don't remember that. But anyway, not a good guy. And as I said, more and more of this is coming out each time. So it was amazing. The testimony is amazing. The judge got very upset. The marshal told me, because I'm going to question him, she said, I'm going to sit over in the witness box, the jury box. If I stand up, that means that you're asking questions that might get too close to revealing his identity. So if I stand up, go in a different direction. She apparently didn't tell that to the judge, because as soon as the judge intervened and started asking questions, she was up like a bolt. And he just kept right on going, asking lots of questions of this guy. And it was pretty amazing. But my one takeaway from that, and it was an intense little relationship that we formed with this guy. You know, you need to gain his trust and work with him and, you know, even have some affection for the guy. At the same time, you know, how many times did he tell us that I'm a bus driver, I'm a good guy, I stop. If people are coming running for the bus, I stop. I'm a good person. The takeaway that I have from this is that PTSD does not only affect the victims. PTSD affects the perpetrators as well.
I wish we had more time to go a bit more into the trial and tell a few more stories from that. But what I'm going to do is I do want to get to the questions and you know, maybe we can lead off, you know, onto other stories from there. So I think, Terry, I'm gonna address this question to you. What has happened to Roberto Davison and members of the Salvadoran oligarchy who funded the murder?
Yeah, what's happening, Roberto Davison is dead. He died of throat cancer. He was someone I interviewed extensively through the entire Civil War. He actually played a important role in the signing of the peace agreements by basically saying, I'm dying, I'm meeting my maker, and oh my God, I've killed all these priests. And his sister was a nun. So he...
25 years ago this week.
Yeah. 25 years ago this week he died.
No, peace accords.
Oh, the peace accords. Excuse me. I'm sorry. So he's dead. He was not a person that we could have gone after because he was dead. Saravia worked for him. I think that the hope of all of us has been to go after the people who paid for this because they are still living very nice lives. Those people have been named, publicly named, with one error. First by the ambassador, the Salvadoran ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, Robert White, who is also dead. Later by others. They have been interviewed. They have been named in a wonderful story, by the way, that is called How We Killed Archbishop Romero by Carlos Dada. So if you want to see all their names, you can see them. Anybody who knows El Salvador will recognize a number of them. I can only say that this story is not yet over. And I really can't say more than that.
Yeah, no, that's and I will add there, too, one of the things that I tried. Well, if the book hadn't taken me 10 years to write, this all would have come out before Carlos's phenomenal reporting. But what I tried to do at the end of the book was tie together the time period between the end of the end of our trial and Carlos's amazing reporting and tell a bit of that story as well. So that is in the book. I realized that I forgot to say a few lines here before we dove into the question, so I'm going to do this again just for the recording. So just a reminder that I am Matt Eisenbrandt, and I am the author of Assassination of a Saint. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to the program Assassination of a Saint, Reflections on the U.S. Trial for the Killing of Oscar Romero, with Matt Eisenbrandt, Almudena Bernabeu, Russell Cohen, Terry Carl, and Nico Van Alstyne. We've got a lot of phenomenal questions, and I'm sorry that we're not going to get to all of them. What I'd like to do is come back to Nico, and this question is, what was it that convinced the very busy judge, I don't remember if it was Russ or Nico, I'll let either one of you take this here. What was it that convinced the judge to give us a week of court time? Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I mentioned the judge was a military man, and I think as he came to see more of this evidence and understand more about what we were going to show, the events that we were talking about offended him to his core. He had a tremendous amount of integrity, and he saw in the evidence that was going to be presented that this was a system that had become so corrupted. That the military was owned, that these killings were being paid for by the oligarchs, that I think he felt that this was something that was important enough to hear. So, I think the lesson is that he was moved slowly, bit by bit. There was no sudden turn, but he really came around as he heard more and more of this.
I'm going to give a slight different twist on that. I agree with you, but I think you jumped ahead. At the time that he made the decision to give us the hearing, it was precisely the opposite. I think he identified with the military that were being accused of having committed such terrible crimes. And he was going to say, he gave us the time. He says, you can't make such grave allegations and get a default. You know, this isn't just some contract. So if you're going to make these kind of allegations, you damn well better, put up or shut up. And that is the change that occurred at the actual hearing then. We went in thinking it was a damages case, and after one witness, we realized that we were in trouble. Because the judge, as I mentioned him questioning the shooter, he actively questioned all of our witnesses. And he said, there's no defense counsel, I'll be the defense counsel. And he put us to our proof. And so the drama of that week was scrambling to extract from all these witnesses who had come here to testify about how wonderful Archbishop Romero was and the importance of his legacy, to then put down evidence. And it turns out we had an incredible fortuitous collection of folks that were able to provide key testimony, including Father John Cortina, who processed the film of the famous photographs that are in the book, and he told that story. Judge Attilio, another incredible story. So over the course of that, I agree with you. He came to feel that. But I'll conclude with one last anecdote. When it came time, and we came back, it wasn't just one week. When it came time for the final hearing, the final day, and it extended beyond 5 o'clock, the air conditioning turned off in that Fresno courtroom, and it got hot and stuffy. And we finished our concluding argument, and then Judge Wenger began to dictate his ruling from the bench. Which he said he would do. And he went on at some great length. I don't remember how long, but it was quite a long time. And it was not looking good, folks. This was going on, and the courtroom was full, and we were feeling not good. And then he kept going and going and going to the evidence, and in the end, judgment for the petitioner, $10 million verdict. The cries of Monsignor Romero Presente rang out in the courtroom. It was amazing. And the court report, his clerk, when we called to get the transcript later, she told us, I've been working with him for 20 years. I always know what he's going to do. And I didn't know what he was going to do. So, he put us to the proof, and we managed to present it.
Can I just add one thing
sure.
to that? I think one of the things, and I agree with you, I think he was totally offended. Because he's really the person who most cross-examined me. And it was all about how the military functioned. And one of the things, he couldn't grasp death squads inside of a military. I mean, it was really hard for him. And the other thing is, and I did say this, see, you can't just be a driver in a death squad. I'm sorry, but death squads don't work that way. The way death squads work is you must murder somebody. And you must do it with other people around, because if you're a witness in the same murder in El Salvadoran law, you can't testify. So you always, always, if you're going to go out and kill somebody, you always, the people around you, you must have something on them. So, you know, if the driver isn't going to kill Archbishop Romero, he's going to kill somebody else, and somebody else knows it, so that if he decides to talk, they can talk about him, unless he's gotten out of the country and he's out of Dodge, which is what he was.
Okay, so the next question, Almo, I'm going to pass this one to you. Was it dangerous to investigate and pursue the case and the investigation? How did you handle security when the defendants or targets of your work were military or, in fact, killers themselves?
I think I hinted at that with my wonderful bodyguards. What can I say? Yes, I think investigating these cases, not exclusively in El Salvador, but we're talking about El Salvador, has some risk. But the truth is that as an NGO lawyer, and perhaps because resources or some systems about security are not in place or whatever the proper, I didn't think much about it. And it was not until my third or fourth case that I had active threats, which made me, and particularly in Guatemala, that made me more aware that we were crossing lines and that we had very little to rely on. But I think that the Romero case is perhaps, I have to be honest, we haven't talked about it, but after that came the Carranza case, and after that I was lucky enough to then start and persuade everybody that was listening to bring a criminal case in Spain under universal jurisdiction for the assassination of the Jesuits in Central America, in UCA, in El Salvador in 1989. I had received a lot more threats and a lot of a lot more nasty stuff, including things that implicated my family through the case of the Jesuits. So I think the Romero case had the power as such an important figure that I think kept them a little bit quieter. And also I think the reason, this is more my personal opinion, the Romero case at the time we investigated, Sarabia ran away. We didn't get to touch that, but he was hiding in the border between El Salvador and Honduras in very miserable conditions. He had no power and didn't retain power within El Salvador. A couple of friends, but no power in the old sense. And for instance, the difference perhaps with the Jesuits' case is that the high commanders responsible for masterminding and ordering the death are still businessmen, and they kept power, and they are kind of the artifices of the amnesty law and all the prerogatives that the powerful, both politically and economically, set up to retain the power past the peace accords and past that period. So yes, I guess the short answer is yes, it's dangerous, but you know, due also thanks to the people from the country learn how to maneuver that.
My first present to Almudena was a St. Christopher medal.
Okay, so we've just got a couple of minutes remaining here. There are a lot of good questions. I'm trying to figure out what's the best one to end on. There are a couple of questions in here about how we knew about the driver. So, for example, why was the driver in the witness protection program? Who brought him in? What was he being protected from? And I can give a little of the backstory, Terry, why don't you take a 2 minute gander at that?
So what happened in El Salvador is there were elections repeatedly, and the United States always backed the Christian Democratic Party candidate, and had taken a firm position that Roberto Dabuisson, who wanted desperately to be president of the country, could never be president without cutting off U.S. aid. So the ARENA party that Almu referred to earlier, the right-wing party, put up other candidates. He was the president of the party, but he never became a presidential candidate after he was stopped in 1983, in the 1983 elections. So in the 84 and 88 elections, the fight for the United States was, oh, my God, if the death squad party, that's how we, you know, the party whose president is a death squad guy, and there are death squads operating out of his office in the Congress. If that party takes power, we can no longer be involved in the civil war. We can no longer aid the military. The guy's such a thug. It's all going to come out. They're going to talk about the nuns. They're going to, you know. So the idea was that in order to support the Christian Democratic Party, more and make sure that ARENA lost, was to reopen the Romero case, because the Romero case implicated the right-wing party ARENA. It had not formed at that time, but the people who killed Archbishop Romero were the founders of the ARENA party subsequently, and the money is the same money that went into the ARENA party. So the idea was, we're going to reopen this case. It's going to make the Christian Democrats win. It was really a political ploy. It didn't work because it was widely seen as a political ploy by the United States to elect the Christian Democrats rather than as something that might actually be a justice initiative. In that process, the United States government found the driver. And they interviewed him, which are the interviews that
in Costa Rica.
Yeah, they interviewed him. They talked to him for a long time.
He gave testimony to a court in El Salvador.
And he gave testimony to a court. His testimony in our case is actually more extensive because Nico's right. Every perpetrator, more and more and more and more. The more you talk to them, the more it comes out. And in his case, he bargained to go into the witness protection program so that he would be safe, so that when there was a trial in El Salvador, which was going to be the trial that made the Christian Democrats win, he would then get to come back home and he would be safe. In other words, he was going to testify against these people, but come back and be safe in the witness protection program. That's why he did those earlier things. That's why he's in the witness protection program, and it's also why you can't touch him for anything.
And there's, just to tie a bow on that, after all of this drama through our case and finding him and figuring out the witness protection program and everything, I did, in researching the book, found amongst the thousands of pages of documents that we had for the case, a few declassified U.S. government documents talking about their communications with the Salvadoran government and the failure of witness protection measures in El Salvador, and the fact that the U.S. government was now being asked for help to bring him into the United States. So I think I'm going to bring this wonderful discussion to a close. I want to thank so much our panelists, Terry Carl, Nico Van Alstyne, Ana Lumena Bernabeu, Russell Cohen, and we thank our audience here as well as those listening in the recording. And now, this meeting in the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.